Welcome to Mexico Matters, the CSIS podcast about how events occurring in Mexico can impact, and more importantly, matter in the United States. I am Mariana Campero, non-resident senior associate of the Americas program at CSIS and the former CEO of the Mexican Council on Foreign Relations, COMEXI. On June 2nd, 100 million Mexicans will be choosing not only between two female candidates for president, but also between continuing the policies of President López Obrador or adopt a more open business-friendly model. Whoever wins and by what margin will determine in large part the type of country Mexico will be during this decade. To speak with me about how the markets are perceiving Mexico and what are the different scenarios that could tilt the risk balance one way or the other, that it is truly my pleasure to welcome Luis de la Calle, a very well-known economist, former NAFTA negotiator, and the CEO of CMM Asociados, and Martin Castellanos, head of LATAM research at the Institute of International Finance. Martin, Luis, welcome to Mexico Matters. Martin, let me start by asking you to give us a little bit of context. What is the general mood of the international business and investment community vis-a-vis Mexico in light of this very important election?
Thank you very much, Mariana, for having me today, along with Luis. From our frequent interaction with our members at the IIF, I would say the investor sentiment toward Mexico is quite positive. I think this is driven mostly by the recent economic activity overperformance, so very positive growth momentum, and also favorable growth prospects on the back of increased opportunities from the global geopolitical landscape, including nearshoring, and also the spillovers of stronger than expected U.S. economy. Growth in Mexico has surprised on the upside last year, about 3%, which is historically high. Keep in mind that the country's long-term average growth is only around 1.5%. After a brief deceleration in the last quarter, activity regained traction at the beginning of the year. Recent high-frequency indicators show a more mixed picture, but it seems the economy is on track to grow above 2.5% this year. This growth rate seems low given the economic and social needs, but it's much better than the pre-COVID stagnant economy. But when you look at the drivers of growth, this year you have like big minimum wage increases, heavy pre-election fiscal spending. So the sustainability of these growth rates going forward is much more uncertain. Then the Mexican peso has remained very strong, mostly due to external factors. Inflation has come down. The current account deficit is well balanced. So in that sense, Mexico looks better than other countries in the region. I took a group of global investors to Mexico City a few weeks ago. The mood there was particularly positive, I would say, significantly positive. That was a bit surprising. And it was positive not only because of the factors that I mentioned, but also because of some expectation of policy improvements after the June election, which in my view is a bit questionable. So we are a bit more cautious than that. And I guess we can discuss about that further later on.
Luis, is this significant optimism that Martin is talking about justified? I mean, what is really the economic reality of Mexico today, and how do you see it moving forward?
Well, happy to be back in Mexico Matters, Mariana, and happy to join in the session with Martin. As Martin was mentioning, we had a better than expected year in 2023, and the question is whether that better year was due to something that happened in 23 or a response more to structural issues. And my sense is that it does respond to structural changes that are important. One is, I think I would point to three of them. One is the integration of the North American markets proceeding, accelerating on their nearshoring, and that will continue. The second one is that we have a significant improvement of the labor market in Mexico. That is also structural. The cohorts that join the labor force are increasingly smaller. And that means that we have a certain degree of labor scarcity that pushes wages up. We have record increases in real wages in the last, not only few years, but in the last 12 years, they've been increasing, and a very low unemployment rate. And the third reason is that Mexican firms have proven to be much more competitive than they were before. Mexican firms and also multinationals that operate in Mexico. The question for Mexico is whether, and Martin already implied some of this in his previous comment, is whether we can pass the obstacles implied in the 2024 cycle that will have a lot of politics and the 2025 cycle in which Mexico's reputation of sound public finances will be put to a test in the markets. So if we have a successful 24 and a successful 25, I think then Mexico will profit from these tailwinds that are structural, and the Mexican economy will grow beyond its former potential.
Luis, before I dig deeper into part of your response, let me just ask Martin, what are the biggest risks that he sees going forward?
In terms of risks, investors should keep an eye on three idiosyncratic and also highly uncertain themes ahead of the June election. The first one is monetary and fiscal policy action in the coming month. The second one is Pemex, as the company faces the risk of debt restructuring. And the third one is, of course, the upcoming policy shift by the next administration, which is a whole different story. So maybe on the first two, the first one, monetary policy and fiscal policy, headline inflation has come down significantly already, mainly as a result of very restrictive monetary policy stance. I mean, let's keep in mind that real interest rates in Mexico are among the highest in Latin America. But services inflation has stabilized at a higher level. So after adjusting the policy rate in March, the main issue the market is concerned about is this the beginning of the easing cycle, or the central bank will pause again to reassess inflation dynamics? We think the central bank could pause, but it will begin the easing cycle by mid this year. There are several risks there. Sticky core prices, the timing for Federal Reserve monetary policy easing, the need to anchor inflation expectations, and what Luis have just said, I mean, the implications of the ongoing fiscal expansion, fiscal consolidation of 3% of GDP in 2025 will not be easy to achieve by the next administration. This aspect is the critical one, I think. It will be a key challenge for the next administration. And if we see limited progress on this front, that could complicate the disinflation process, that could affect inflation expectations, and that could interfere with monetary policy easing. And at the end of the day, that would affect growth. The second factor is Pemex. That has been for long a source of investor concern. We have declining oil production, sustained federal government transfers to the company, very adverse debt dynamics. We have seen a deterioration in the company's financial position. Market participants think the next administration will be more pressured to open up the energy sector to private investment and also the company. We agree that financial assistance by the government will continue no matter what, but the challenge is that the fiscal space to do so it will be much more limited, particularly because the size of social programs have taken up most of the fiscal space. We have heard many interesting things in Mexico in terms of what could be done if there is political will with the company. I mean, investment to increase the electrical grid, more reliant on joint ventures, farm outs, investing in natural gas, monetizing emission reductions. But of course, all this requires political support, a forceful policy shift. And in my view, that's unlikely to happen in the near term.
Luis, before we talk about nearshoring or monetary and fiscal policy or Pemex, let me ask you about the elections, since the result and the margin of victory will determine what policies will Mexico adopt and whether or not there will be any shift in direction. What do you think will determine this election? Will it be the economy or something else?
If the economy is going to determine the election result, Claudia Sheinbaum will win.
Correct.
I mean, if that's the main driver of the election, because, I mean, most Mexicans, I mean, as I said at the beginning, I mean, we have record increases in real wages, and a 2.7% unemployment rate. I mean, that explains the president's popularity and explains why Morena is ahead. We have a strong peso. People associate the strong peso with the well-being. I mean, the opposition might win. In spite of that, the main driver is economics. Morena is the favorite to win the election in June. No, there is two aspects that might reduce the margin and, or flip the margin to Xochitl's side. The first one is whether there is disenchantment in terms of people that voted for Morena in 2018, and now they might either stay home or switch to Xochitl. That would be one. And the second one is turnout. The higher the turnout, the more difficult it becomes to predict the election result. So, but I mean, if you have to bet today, in the month of April, you would bet in favor of Claudia Sheinbaum winning. But I mean, we'll see. I mean, we have 2 months to go.
I read an article, Luis, in which you did a very interesting exercise, right? Sort of, if the turnout is 58% or less, then Morena has a chance not only to win the presidency, but also the chamber in Mexico City. However, if that turnout, together with the disenchantment that you talked about, is greater, particularly in the northern states, then the election can be much closer. Can you sort of give us a little bit more detail on that?
Well, I mean, the margin, as your question implied, Mariana, is a crucial component, not only for the election, but also for what comes later in terms of public policy, in terms of governability, and the political configuration of the country. So if you read opinion polls, I mean, you have some opinion polls that give 30 points to Claudia Sheinbaum or Xochitl Galvez, some others give 20 points, and some much less, depending on whether there are surveys that are done in households or by telephone or through the internet, no, depending on the three configurations. So the question analytically is whether that margin can be reduced. And one way to look at it is to begin with the result of 2018, where López Obrador won 30 million votes with 53% of the vote and 63% turnout. So if you begin with that initial, the question is, can Claudia replicate López Obrador? And can Xochitl replicate Ricardo Anaya plus José Antonio Meade? No? Because López Obrador won 30 million votes, and José Antonio Meade and Ricardo Anaya won, between the two of them, 22.5 million. If there is disenchantment, and some of the, Claudia is not able to bring some of those 30 million to her side, the question is whether they go home or they switch to favor Xochitl. So the first thing is there a level of disenchantment? There is some. It's not uniform across the country, but in some regions of the country, there is. The second question is, will they vote or they'll stay home? And then the other question is, can Xochitl replicate some of the success that Vicente Fox had in 2000 in terms of bringing people out in central and northern Mexico? And the final question is, can Claudia bring as many people as López Obrador did out in southern Mexico in terms of turnout? Well, with combination of that, you can make a very simple arithmetical exercise to see whether the margin can be reduced. The main driver of reducing the margin is disenchantment. And the second one is turnout. If disenchantment is more than people think, I mean, the number I used, just an example, was 10%, and turnout is higher than in the past, the election will be closer than people think. That's basically that. I mean, as you said, if turnout is 58% or less, Morena will win everything. If turnout is 63.4, which was the turnout in 2018, the election will be won by Claudia Sheinbaum, but it's closer than polls are saying. If turnout is north of 65%, then it will be much closer, and potentially Xochitl might have a chance of turning things around. It will be unprecedented to have that high turnout in the Mexican election. Now, if you look at the debate on Sunday, rating was relatively high compared to other debates. It was higher than the highest in 2018, a little higher than the one that attracted a lot of attention with AMLO, Ricardo Anaya, and José Antonio Meade 6 years ago.
Yeah, which is interesting because it tells you at least that people are paying attention to the election.
It's an early indicator that turnout might not be very low. And if turnout is relatively high, then the margin will be less. And the probability of Morena winning both houses, the Senate and the House of Deputies, will be much less.
Martin, if we use the numbers that Luis just mentioned, and we assume a low voter turnout, and then Claudia and Morena were to win and get a qualified majority, what would be your biggest concern under that scenario?
Yeah, well, first, let me say that in line with what Luis was saying, is that I think that the race is still open. I mean, there are several factors. The reliability of the polls as well, the uncertainty regarding turnout that Luis was talking about, and also that the presidential campaign is at an initial stage. There are several issues to be discussed, to be debated yet that haven't been addressed, public security, foreign policy. So to your question, I think a landslide ruling party's victory could pave the way for constitutional reforms. That is clearly seen as a tail risk by the market because pressure to pass reforms could undermine economic and political institutions in Mexico. That will likely escalate. If that happens, I think Mexico could be in a much more weaker position when competing for foreign investment with other countries in the region and other emerging markets. I think that would also affect the relationship with the U.S. Most analysts we talked about think that USMCA agreement, which is set for a six-year review in 2026, should kind of contain the policy uncertainty. But I think the focus on immigration, public security ahead of the U.S. presidential election as well could result in downward pressure on the peso. And under this condition, under the scenario that you described, then we could see higher chances of more interventionist policies, and that would add significant volatility and would weigh on market sentiment.
Luis, let's play the other scenario. Let's assume that Claudia wins by a smaller margin and that they don't have control of the two houses. What will be your expectations in terms of public policies?
Regardless of how big the Morena win is, I think that by November, we'll know what kind of government we'll have for the next 6 years. Because in November, you'll have two things that are very important. The first one is the presentation of the economic package on November 15th. I mean, the new government will have to present the package for 2025. That will include, of course, the budget. It will include the forecast for growth. It will include whether they have any new initiatives that might change the economic landscape. And it will include, of course, the forecast they have for the budget deficit. I think we'll end up this year with a budget deficit north of 6% of GDP. The government is saying now that it's going to be 5.9, but they are assuming a growth of 3%. I think the growth will be less than 3%, and then the budget deficit will be a little higher. And then the question, as Martin was implying at the beginning, is how do you reduce that deficit? Because the markets will... If they repeat that same level of deficit next year, the markets will not take that lightly. So that will happen in November. We'll see whether they have other things to complement the attractiveness of Mexico in terms of economics in that package. The other decision that is crucially important is that the new president of Mexico will have to choose the new candidates for a justice in the Supreme Court. And the signaling of who that person is in terms of how... In the case Claudia Sheinbaum wins, how she responds to the different political groups within Morena will be very important. Because if she appoints a militant Morena lawyer that will disregard the constitution, no, and give the Morena a block of four justices that can rule constitutional laws that are unconstitutional, in their face, then the signal will be that little will happen in terms of the economic changes. The country needs to be really attractive for investment. So that would be the first test as to not only where her vision is, but the politics within Morena. If the more radical members of Morena force her to choose a radical justice, then I think that would be a signal that will be interpreted by markets, by investors, that there will be not enough change in Mexico to really take advantage of the tailwinds that Mexico has, and that maybe, I mean, the conditions, the political conditions are not ready for Mexico to really take advantage of those. And therefore, that will complicate the macroeconomic scenario, because the best antidote to the risks that Martin was mentioning, and I would add risks also coming from overseas in terms of economic behavior in other countries.
USMCA being one of them.
I think the larger risk for Mexico is a recession in the U.S. The way to face a recession in the U.S. is to be very competitive domestically. But if you don't have the political will or the political ability or the political capital to implement some reforms, then Mexico will be hard-pressed, and the markets will begin to have a different view on Mexico on those two counts, the presentation of the budget on November 15th and the selection of the new justice for the Supreme Court in that month.
Luis, is it your expectation that Claudia will be able to distance herself from AMLO, or we will see something closer to the Brazilian model in which Dilma, at least at the beginning, allowed Lula to have influence in the presidential palace?
It will depend on her ability to deal with the different groups that are part of the Morena coalition. I mean, if she develops enough political capital and enough political room to maneuver, and she's able to control, we have to remember that Morena resembles the PRI of the past, but it's not the PRI. I mean, the PRI was a party, or it's not as of yet. The PRI was a party where you had a lot of discipline. And in Morena, you don't have that discipline. The person that imposes discipline on Morena is Andrés Manuel López Obrador. So if she has to call Palenque every now and then to ask for support from the president or the former president so that people get in line and they don't do things that are unseemly, then she will be unable to move away from the orthodoxy of López Obrador. Now, if she can operate independently from Palenque, which is where López Obrador will retire to, then she'll be able to do different things. We don't know the answer to that, but I mean, the first signal of that will be the economic package. Well, the composition of the cabinet, of course, the economic package presented in November, and the selection of the new justice.
Martin, I mean, nearshoring, certainly everybody's talking about it in Mexico, and it is certainly happening to a certain degree, right? Foreign direct investment has reached a high, machinery and equipment imports are up, but other countries, as you said, are competing too. What is the expectation on Mexico? Will Claudia, after everything that Luis just mentioned, will be able to take advantage of this wave and be able to control sort of that radical wing of the Morena party that, you know, wants to have a stronger role of the state and wants to have a more control in the economy?
Yeah. So you're right. These days it's impossible to have a conversation about Mexico without referring to nearshoring. That's a powerful factor. And I think in terms of the next administration policy changes and in order to be able to take advantage of these, I think there is a bit of wishful thinking in the market regarding that the next administration would be willing and able to deliver market-friendlier policies. We are a bit more cautious. I mean, we will have more information after the election, of course, and when the new administration presents the economic package and make the appointments. But with the information that we have right now, our view is that this sort of center-left interventionist approach will be maintained, even though we will see more pressure on the next administration to deliver market-friendly policies. Monetary and fiscal policies also will keep supporting macroeconomic stability, although we could see a weaker commitment to fiscal austerity, and that's something that we will see in November with the presentation of the package, but it seems to me that that could be the case. Of course, I think central bank autonomy will remain. It's the benefits are so clear by also by this administration. public management could become more professional, at least in some areas. I think renewable energies, transportation. We don't see a radical Pemex reform, energy reform, at least at the beginning. And then regarding sort of the influence of the current administration, we think at the beginning it would be strong that she will remain loyal to AMLO, but that could change afterwards if particularly pressure to deliver market-friendlier policies intensify. I think the margin of victory also would be important, particularly in terms of the relationship with the U.S. But I think that policy response would not be or might not be enough in order to fully benefit from these nearshoring opportunities. I think Mexico faces significant shortcomings when it comes to infrastructure, logistics. So that will require policies that are more friendlier toward investment, toward private investment, in order for Mexico to benefit for that. I think the risk that I see is sort of some complacency in terms of understanding nearshoring as a sort of a substitute for these policies. And that, I think, would be a mistake. I think these external tailwinds could help, but they are not enough. Those sort of policy improvements will be required.
Luis, let me talk about a little bit more about this external tailwinds. What about China? I mean, Chinese direct investment in Mexico has hit a record high. I think last year was 587 million. Two-way trade between the two countries is also increasing, and Chinese visitors to Mexico has rebounded almost to pre-pandemic levels. In fact, a direct flight was announced to start between Shenzhen and Mexico. How do you see this play out in the midst of the U.S.-China tensions and considering what you guys mentioned before, that there's going to be a renegotiation of USMCA? Will the United States allow China to use Mexico as the backdoor?
Well, I mean, that's a very important question, Mariana. There's a lot of misunderstandings about that. The more nearshoring you have, the more Asian investment will happen in Mexico. No, the more nearshoring you have, the larger the number of containers coming to Mexican ports. Because, I mean, if you don't have nearshoring, then everything will happen in Asia. The difference is when you have an operation in North America, be that in Mexico or in the U.S., that manufacturing operation will have North American content. When the U.S. only functions only on the receiving end of imports coming from Asia, U.S. content is zero. If we want to have more nearshoring in terms of having more integration of North American supply chains and better compete with China, that will produce more Asian investment into Mexico and also into the U.S. and therefore a different type of trading relationship with across the Pacific. So we'll be importing more capital equipment that will be installed in Mexico or in Texas or in Alabama, and we'll get more inputs from Asia, so that they get incorporated into North American manufacturing. So when people complain about there's too many containers coming into Mexico from China, I mean, basically what they're saying, we don't like nearshoring. We like the containers to come directly from Shanghai to the U.S. in the form of final goods. Well, that is not nearshoring. That is the status quo, as if nothing happened. There will be some significant political pressure in the U.S., particularly in certain sectors, that will try to prevent the growth of Chinese firms, particularly in the auto sector. No? If an auto manufacturer from China establishes itself in North America, it hasn't happened as of yet. To produce electrical vehicles here, they will have two options. One is to do their operation in Mexico or in the U.S., and comply with the rule of origin under USMCA, which is very strict. And that means that most of that car will be North American in content. Or they may want to assemble a Chinese car in Mexico and then export that to the U.S. and pay the MFN duty. Now, the problem will come if the U.S. tries to impose a duty, as President Biden has implied and Candidate Trump has actually said, that will be different from the WTO duty. because then there will be a question of a rule of origin, a double rule of origin. A rule of origin for NAFTA, for USMCA origin, and a rule of origin that you have to prove that your car is not Chinese. A negative rule of origin. And that will produce a lot of friction. But I mean, besides this, the auto sector, I will say something that is politically incorrect. The best measure of how large nearshoring is not foreign direct investment into Mexico, is the trade deficit that the U.S. has with Mexico. The larger the trade deficit with Mexico, it means that there is more production capacity being installed in Mexico. But I mean, the same thing happens if a plant is established in Texas. The more investment you get in Texas, the larger the trade deficit the 49 states will have with Texas, no? Because Texas will be exporting. Well, the larger the trade deficit that the U.S. runs with Mexico, the larger nearshoring is actually happening, because that's what it means. But I mean, that trade deficit does not damage the U.S. because the U.S. participates in the production chains in North America, and it does not participate when the production happens in Asia.
Nearshoring is also very challenging to identify in the data. As you said, Mariana, I mean, investment has increased, machinery, non-residential construction. Private investment is no longer a drag on growth in Mexico, which is a good thing. So it looks like firms are preparing, expanding capacity to tap the U.S. market. I think USMCA is helping on this front. But when you look at foreign direct investment inflows, they have remained very, very weak, particularly when what we call true FDI, which is excluding reinvested earnings. Mexico inflows have been very, very weak, even compared to other Latin American countries. The average in terms of the size of the economy is above what Mexico gets. If Mexico were to get the average of just the average of a Latin American country in terms of FDI inflows, it should be getting, instead of 30, 40 billion per year, it should be getting 60, 70 billion per year. Foreign direct investment inflows are below remittances inflows. So there is a lot of potential there, but I think there's going to be significant competition from other Latin American countries that have also free trade agreements with the U.S. and that have also highly integrated, very short and compact supply chains with the U.S., and that would require some sort of policy improvements in order for Mexico to fully benefit.
And if we were going to do those policy improvements, probably the deficits that Luis was talking about will increase. And so I remember when we started the renegotiation of NAFTA, you know, deficits was one of the biggest issues, right, in their agenda. So we might see something similar happening.
With the caveat that now the deficit is twice as much.
Right.
And the deficit being twice as much means that there is investment coming into Mexico.
Correct.
To supply the U.S.
Hopefully they will understand it.
Well, no, they will. I mean, they will not. But I mean, we need to make an effort to educate people that the best way to measure nearshoring is not investment flows, it's the trade deficit.
And even though the candidates in the U.S. are well known, the uncertainty is significant still about that.
Absolutely.
The North American integration will continue in spite of the politics, because there is structural, very strong forces for that to happen. And the benefits are clear for everybody. So, but I mean, we'll see some bumps in the road, and Mexico has to be very smart as to how we deal with the frictions that will come as this process goes forward.
Let me ask you the same question to both before we close. What keeps you up at night?
In terms of economics or?
In terms of economic or policies.
Well, I mean, I think the larger risk that we face is that interest rates in the U.S. will increase.
And that will create competition.
Not the Fed, market interest rates. I mean, that is the larger risk that I think the economy has, is that the U.S. Treasury will not find enough buyers to place their bonds. And that will increase interest rates in the U.S. That will be a challenge for everybody, including of course, Mexico and also the U.S. I think that the Wall Street is a little too optimistic that we'll have a secular decline in interest rates. I think we are in for a period longer than people think of high real interest rates. That is, I think, the largest risk that we have.
Martin?
I think the market has clearly moved towards Luis' view more recently, given the stronger numbers from the U.S. economy. That's a risk as well. I'm more concerned about sort of the domestic policies and the need to attract investment. I think they are the countries that move faster in the region, in Latin America, to provide those signals to foreign investors, I think would be disproportionately benefit from those signals. We haven't seen so much yet on that front, not only in Mexico, but also in other countries. But I think the popular sort of public demand for that will pick up.
Well, I mean, I think, Mariana, if I can add to that, if Mexico has a successful electoral process, and success should be measured by how many people actually vote and the people respecting the results of the election, it will be a significant improvement on Mexico's condition. Now, if on the other side, I mean, we had an election that is contested and we have significant post-electoral frictions, then that would be not very good news.
I will close on that note, Luis. Let's certainly hope that a lot of Mexicans understand what is at stake and come out to vote, and that we can have a smooth transition of power. And no matter who wins, let's also hope that they can take a more pragmatic approach and try to take advantage of the external opportunities, because as Martin said, if we don't, somebody else will. Thank you very, very much to both. It was truly a pleasure to have this conversation. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this podcast, check out our larger suite of CSIS podcasts. From Into Africa, The Asia Chessboard, China Power, AIDS 2020, The Trade Guys, Smart Women, Smart Power, and more. You can listen to them all on major streaming platforms like iTunes and Spotify. Visit csis.org/podcasts to see our full catalog.